Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You look great. What have you been doing?
I found Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe the same active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s for 80 to 90% less without insurance. All of mine shipped right to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call #250 and say keyword care. That's care to #250.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
All right, Mr. Jackson, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Mr. DeSogra, could you please state your full name and spell your last name for the jurors, please?
Sure. Matthew DeSogra, last name D-I-S-O-G-R-A.
What do you do for a living, sir?
I am a licensed professional engineer. I practice in the field of accident reconstruction. And within that field, I specialize in analysis, interpretation, accessing all types of vehicle data.
How are you currently employed?
I'm employed by Delta V Forensic Engineering, which is an engineering firm that specializes in accident reconstruction, all parts of accident reconstruction.
Tell us a little bit more about Delta V. What is it? What kind of company is it? But other than that specialty, what else does it do?
So accident reconstruction is a broad field. There are a lot of subspecialties within that. So accident reconstruction is everything from the initial investigation phases of a crash all the way through testimony, like here today. Some of the specialties within that could be things like biomechanics, could be human factors, and my specialty is data, vehicle data and event data recorders.
On that topic, what is your current title or position with Delta V?
I am the director of engineering for our EDR services line.
What does EDR services mean?
Event data recorders. So EDR is a general term we can use to talk about all types of data from all types of vehicles.
And how would you describe your role as the director of engineering for EDR services for Delta V?
I wear a couple of different hats. First and foremost, I'm still a practicing engineer. I still conduct investigations. I still perform analyses, and I testify. On top of that, in the director role, I oversee a group. It's not just me doing this kind of work. I have three other engineers that work with me, all specializing in EDRs. So I oversee that group and focus on kind of the day-to-day operations as well as the direction we're going. You know, with things like autonomous vehicles coming, the role of data is growing, so we're kind of looking to the future in a lot of those ways.
As a consulting engineer, you've indicated what your specialization is. Do you specialize in motor vehicle accident reconstruction as well as vehicle system analyses?
I began my career at Delta V doing traditional accident reconstruction in the broadest sense, and as I have progressed, I have sort of narrowed myself down and now specialize in that, but I still consider myself an expert in accident reconstruction because ultimately anytime we're doing EDR data analysis, it is in support of an accident reconstruction.
You talked about event data recorders. Do you also engage in the specialty of advanced data recovery methods? In other words, methods of pulling the data. It's one thing to have it sitting in a car. It's another thing to pull it out and make it useful, correct?
That's right. There are a lot of different ways data can be accessed, all the way from just plugging into a port on a working vehicle, all the way through when a vehicle is catastrophically damaged and even the modules themselves are damaged, accessing the data at the chip level. So no matter what condition a vehicle or the remnants of a vehicle are in, generally we can still get the data from that.
Do you have any specific knowledge about Toyota data?
I do.
Describe that for us.
Beyond Toyota being a common vehicle in general, so we run into that data quite frequently. Just this year, we published a paper specifically studying some of the behaviors of the additional data recorder that's in Toyota vehicles.
Does Toyota make another sub-brand, for lack of a better phrase?
Lexus, I believe you're. Mm-hmm.
So Lexus is a Toyota brand.
Right. Correct.
Okay. What is infotainment? It's kind of a combination of a couple of words, information and entertainment. What is infotainment data as it relates to vehicles, modern vehicles?
So it's a generic term, which more or less means the thing that's in the middle of the dashboard with the screen on it. A lot of manufacturers implement that a little bit differently, so they all look different, but it's a general term we use in the industry to describe that system.
And what about, I'm going to change gears a little bit, what about your experience with regard to GPS as it relates to vehicles on the road, on the common roadways of the country?
GPS is a pretty fundamental part of vehicle data as a whole at this point, and we run into it in a lot of different places. We see GPS data from infotainment systems, so we're analyzing that data. Most of that's GPS-based. I do a lot of heavy truck work, and almost every heavy truck has some kind of GPS system in it for the fleets to track them, so we're analyzing that as part of data. And then the last area would be when we conduct testing, any kind of research, we're generally going to put our own GPS systems on vehicles so we can study that data. So analyzing GPS is a regular part of my job.
GPS, global, I'm going by memory, global positioning satellites?
Global positioning system.
System, got it. GPS is a mechanism to figure out where on earth a certain item might be, whether it's this pin or an 18-wheel tractor trailer, correct?
That's correct.
Is there any difference inherently in the GPS mechanism that's installed in an infotainment center in a Toyota Lexus, Toyota slash Lexus, versus a heavy truck or a heavy vehicle that's on the road?
The core technology behind how it works is fundamentally the same.
What is instrumented testing as it relates to Toyotas and VCH testing and things of that nature? Can you explain that for the jurors?
Sure. What instrumented testing means is, let's say we want to study, let's say, how accurate some data is that comes out of one of these vehicles. So we need an independent source of that information. So what we'll do is we'll equip a vehicle with one of these GPS data acquisition systems. Basically, we can drive the vehicle around and we know exactly where it is, how fast it's going, all these parameters. We can do some maneuvers with the vehicle, then we can download the data that the vehicle stored, and now we can compare the two and say, okay, well, if we have really high confidence in our system, how accurate is the vehicle system? Because the reality is there's always some small errors in these vehicle systems. And in a lot of cases, what's important is quantifying that error.
So you're obviously familiar with GPS systems and many different platforms.
That's correct.
Okay. How many cases have you been a part of in terms of investigating and or analyzing infotainment center or infotainment system data?
Infotainment specifically, probably around 30.
And are you also familiar with engaging in some sort of analysis that's referred to as clock alignment?
Yes.
What is clock alignment?
Clock alignment would mean that anytime we have a timestamp in any set of data, a singular clock value, there's a good likelihood that that's not 100% accurate. So clock alignment would mean finding an independent source of time to compare that to, preferably one that's more reliable, and then making the necessary adjustments so that time can be considered real time.
How many cases have you been involved in that deal with clock alignment specifically?
Thousands, over a thousand. That's a regular part of data analysis. Any data set that has a timestamp, it's normal. It's part of the analysis. It's really the first step is let's get that clock aligned. So it's something I'm doing regularly.
And how long have you worked for Delta V?
It'll be my 13-year anniversary next month, actually.
Okay. These things that you've just described that we've talked about for the last few minutes, these are all duties that you perform within the rubric of your employment as the director, a director of engineering at Delta V, correct?
Correct.
Now let's shift gears real quick and talk about your education, training, and background that qualifies you to perform these duties that you just talked about. Go ahead.
The road is
open and it's yours.
Certainly. So I began my academic career. I got an undergraduate degree in mechanical engineering from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. I then went on and got a master's degree, also in mechanical engineering from the same school. And then when I came out of school, I immediately started working for Delta V Forensic Engineering. In order to get a professional engineer license, I then needed to acquire 4 additional years of work directly under the supervision of another licensed engineer. So then I completed that phase of work. And then in order to maintain my license, I have to complete continuing education every year in the field that I practice.
So you got both a Bachelor of Science, correct?
Correct, Bachelor of Science.
Did you mention the year that you got your Bachelor of Science?
2011.
And you have a Master's?
Correct.
In engineering?
That is correct.
And when did you secure that degree?
2013.
You just mentioned engaging in continuing education. What is continuing education in terms of the engineering field or the reconstruction field in your world?
So in the state that I'm licensed, in North Carolina, they define that really as any activity you're participating in that's keeping you abreast with the field, keeping you up to date with what's going on. So taking formal classes counts for continuing education, but also some of the other work that I do, like publishing research in peer-reviewed journals, also counts as continuing education.
Do you regularly attend symposiums? Or symposia, I guess is the right word.
Yes.
Have you attended symposia related to EDR research and training?
Yes.
How about advanced applications of heavy vehicle EDR data?
Correct, yeah. I attend, there's a couple of regular conferences in our industry specifically tailored to EDRs as a whole for passenger vehicles and heavy trucks. I'm a regular attendee of those. I'm also a regular speaker at most of those. And I'm usually presenting some of the new research that we have for that year.
So not only do you attend, you actually teach?
Correct.
Have you attended events that deal with data, event data recording systems, and event data recording system extraction?
Yes.
What about vehicle crash reconstruction?
Yes.
What about electronic control module imaging?
Yes.
What about electronic control model analysis?
Yes.
Applying automotive EDR data to traffic reconstruction.
Yes.
These are samples of the type of continuing education that you routinely engage in, correct?
All that's accurate.
You talked about additional licenses and professional registrations. You're a licensed professional engineer, correct?
That's correct.
In North Carolina?
Correct.
You're also a certified IPC specialist?
Yes.
What is an IPC specialist?
IPC is an organization that offers certifications in basically soldering. I could say it in more technical ways, but it boils down to soldering. So as it relates to what I do, when we are recovering data from damaged EDRs at the chip level, that involves some really precise soldering work And so IPC offers courses in how to do that at basically the highest level, and then they offer certifications for that.
Are you a member of the Society of Automotive Engineers?
I am, active member.
Is when you say an active member, is that a nationally recognized society for academic engineers?
Yes.
The teaching roles that you've held within organizations, have you been an instructor concerning accessing and interpreting heavy vehicle data event recorders?
I am. I am currently an instructor of that course, which is offered through the Society of Automotive Engineers.
As a matter of fact, next week, are you going someplace to teach?
I am. I will be in Wisconsin next week teaching that very course.
Are you a member of any subcommittees within that organization, within the organization of the Society for Automotive Engineers?
I am. I am a voting member in the J2728 subcommittee, which is a subcommittee for event data recorders on trucks and buses.
Are you also a member of the National Association of Professional Reconstruction Specialists?
I am.
Does that require a certain level of education?
It does, and it requires, as far as I know, when I joined, sort of proof that you are active within the field of accident reconstruction.
That was my next question. It requires you to stay current on accident reconstruction issues, correct?
Correct.
Have you also authored peer-reviewed articles on within your field and
yes.
Subfield? Is it fair to say that you've authored or co-authored a number of peer-reviewed papers in the field of accident reconstruction specifically, as well as EDR data retrieval?
That's correct.
Have any of your peer-reviewed articles that you've either authored or co-authored specifically focused on Toyota vehicles?
Yes.
Can you name one, please?
Specifically, this year, published a paper where we studied the effects of collision-induced power loss on the way data is recorded in Toyota systems. And that would include Lexus systems. Fundamentally, they're the same components. It's just a different brand on top.
In January 2025, did you co-author a publication entitled Simulation of Vehicle Speed Sensor Data for Use in Heavy Vehicle Event Data Recording Testing?
Mr. Jackson, you're going to have to take that.
Of course. Sorry. In January 2025, did you co-author a publication entitled Simulation of Vehicle Speed Sensor Data for Use in Heavy Vehicle Event Data Recorder Testing?
Yes, I was the lead author on that paper.
When you're dealing with retrieving data from a vehicle, an EDR, an event data recorder, Toyota paper, whatever it might be, and that's a term of art, Toyota paper, correct?
Sure.
Does it matter if the vehicle is a heavy vehicle, a small vehicle, a passenger vehicle, a moped, or a skateboard if they happen to have an infotainment center on it?
There are differences, of course, between the data that comes out of passenger vehicles and the data that comes out of heavy trucks, but there are also a lot of fundamental similarities to those. Like, for example, they all record vehicle speed. They all have accelerator pedals. They all have brake pedals. So a lot of the core data we're analyzing is very similar.
In January 2020, did you co-author a publication entitled Chip and Board Level Digital Forensics of Cummins Heavy Vehicle Data Event Recorders?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And what was the fundamental, without getting into the granular details, the fundamental aspect of that paper?
So in that research, we introduced a new technique for getting data out of damaged modules. So, you know, they're either burned, they've been submerged in the water, they're crushed physically from impact. We demonstrated a new method to be able to get data less invasively, but still at the chip level. And we also demonstrated that we could translate that data from the chips outside of the software that was provided. So you could use the software and get the data that way. And we demonstrated we could basically do it ourselves if we wanted to.
Mr. DeSogra, have you been qualified in other courts to testify as an expert in the area of accident reconstruction, EDR data retrieval?
Yes.
How many times?
Once.
When was that?
In New York.
You were deemed qualified as an expert in that court in this field that you're talking about today?
Specifically with as it relates to data, yes.
I want to talk a little bit about what you were asked to do in this case. We asked to undertake a review of certain work performed by a person by the name of Shannon Burgess with Aperture LLC.
Yes.
Are you familiar with Aperture?
Yes.
Before you were asked to undertake that review, were you familiar with Aperture?
Yes.
Were you familiar specifically with Shannon Burgess?
Yes.
Were you asked to engage in any original analysis in this case?
All of my analysis is fundamentally based on all of the data and the numbers provided in the Aperture reports. So more or less the answer to your question is no.
So you were asked specifically to give the court and the jurors clarity on data that Shannon Burgess had analyzed and provided a report about, correct?
Correct.
And that dealt with data obtained from Ms. Reed's SUV, Karen Reed's SUV, correct?
Correct.
Did you, in fact, review Shannon Burgess's report summarizing his findings and conclusions regarding clock drift? That report was dated in January of 2025.
Yes.
And what did you do in that regard?
I analyzed the methods that Mr. Burgess proposed for aligning the clocks in that report.
Were you also asked at some point to review Judson Welch's report and PowerPoint presentation regarding the timing of the TechStream event known as 1162-2, 1162-2?
Yes.
Did you determine whether Dr. Welcher had based his report on Shannon Burgess's analysis?
Yes.
Before we get into that, I want to ask you a couple of questions about TechStream events so we're all talking sort of with the same vocabulary, if we could. When I say TechStream event, have you ever heard that called a trigger event?
Yes.
Are those sort of synonymous?
The event, in order to be generated, has to be triggered by something. So, yes.
You became aware in your analysis, I'm assuming, that Dr. Welcher reported a trigger event at a particular time or span of time, correct?
Correct.
What span of time was that? What time was that?
For which event?
For the 1162-2 event, sorry.
Do you mind if I reference the slide? Because I don't have the number.
With the court's permission.
Go ahead.
Do you have a copy of it in front of you?
I do, Your Honor. So the original analysis places event 1162-2 ending at 12:31:43 a.m.
Now, Dr. Welcher, this is what I want to talk about for just a quick second. Dr. Welcher indicated that the trigger event began at 12:31:38, correct?
I believe so.
That would suggest that a trigger event lasts 5 seconds, 12:31:38 to 12:31:43, correct?
Objection.
Sustained as to form.
Let me ask you this. Does a trigger event or does a TechStream event last 5 seconds or 10 seconds?
The trigger is a singular point in time.
That's my question. All right, so if we're thinking about a trigger event, it's like that clap, snap, right? It's a point in time, not a series of, not a time span, correct?
It's a singular point, correct.
Okay. Does a trigger event or a text stream event cause a recording to bookend the trigger event itself?
Yes.
Explain that for the jurors so that we're very clear about that.
Sure. So when an event is triggered, what we end up with is some data from before the event was triggered and some data from after the event was triggered. The way it does that is it's kind of always recording, and as soon as it sees a trigger, it says, aha, and it goes and it grabs the previous 5 seconds. That number can vary. It can be more or less than five, but for the specific trigger we're talking about, it grabs the previous 5 seconds of data, and then it keeps recording for an additional 5 seconds, and that completes its recording phase.
Right. So if Dr. Welcher indicated that the text stream event, the trigger, was at 12:31:38, would it be accurate if he said that trigger ended at 12:31:43?
Sustained as to form.
Is there any, if a trigger event is one point in time, one snap in time, Would it be accurate to say that the trigger event itself lasted 5 seconds and ended 5 seconds later?
It wouldn't be accurate to say the trigger lasted that long.
That's my question.
The event lasts that long, but the trigger is only one point within the event.
The recording lasts that long.
Right.
Correct?
Correct.
So in other words, it captures, or does it, let me ask you this, does it capture 5 seconds before and 5 seconds after, but the trigger event is the singular point right in the middle?
That's correct.
Okay. If we were to calculate the window between the trigger event or the text stream event and a lock event on John O'Keefe's phone, you analyzed both, correct? Or you reviewed both, correct?
Correct.
Would you calculate from the point of the trigger, would you calculate from 12:31:38, that point in time, and I'm using the tip of my pen to represent the point, at 12:31:38, or would you calculate it from 12:31:43?
Customarily, when we're doing any analysis, we're referencing everything off of the trigger. That's the normal way. Everything in the aperture reports was referenced off of the end of the event. So
of the recording event.
Of the recording event.
Not
so,
the trigger.
Correct. And I didn't correct that. I just went with that convention for all of the analysis I did.
But you noted it, correct?
Correct.
And you noted that that would be 5 seconds inaccurate. I'll withdraw it. I'll ask it a different way. What would be the effect of timing if you were to start at the trigger event, 12:31:38, versus timing the event if you were to start at 12:31:43?
There'd be approximately 5 second difference in every subsequent calculation.
And if, in fact, there was a lock event, which you reviewed, at 12:32:09, how long would the actual window be from the trigger event to 12:32:09?
It would be larger by 5 seconds, approximately.
So it would actually be 31 seconds, correct? Did I do my math right?
You did.
Let's get back, if we can, to the offsets that you identified in Shannon Burgess's, the time offsets that you identified in Shannon Burgess's report. When you applied the potential offsets identified by Mr. Burgess to the TechStream event at 1162-2, what opinions or conclusions did you come to with regard to that analysis or that question?
Sustained, ask it differently.
Did you apply the potential offsets identified by Mr. Burgess in his January 2025 report to the TechStream event 1162-2?
Yes.
Did you also apply Dr. Welcher's analysis based on that same Shannon Burgess analysis to reach an opinion or a conclusion?
Yes.
And what was your opinion or conclusion with regard to that event and the timing following that event?
Based on all of the data in those two original reports, regardless of what adjustment is made or which two points are used to try to correct the clock, the phone lock event always occurs after the end of the event, using their convention of referencing off the end of the event, not the trigger, but it always occurs after.
And that was based on Shannon Burgess's January 2025 report, correct?
Correct.
Sustained.
What was that based on? Which report? We're dealing with two different reports, May and January. I want to make sure we differentiate. Which report are you just now talking about?
I'm talking about the January report.
Now, did Mr. Burgess, were you supplied with a supplemental report by Mr. Burgess?
Yes, I was.
When was that?
slightly after he issued it, but I don't know the exact date.
It was issued on,
his report was dated May 8th, and I think I was provided it a couple days after that. I don't remember the exact date.
So after, do you know when this trial started?
No, I don't know the exact date.
I know you're not watching the trial, but it was in the middle of this trial, correct?
16th.
I'll ask you a different question. With regard to the original report, the January 2025 report, was there any circumstance in which Mr. Burgess and Mr. Welcher could conclude that the lock event on John O'Keefe's phone, that lock event, occurred before the trigger event?
Objection.
Sustained. Ask it differently, Mr. Jackson.
What is your opinion about whether or not there was any analysis done by Mr. Burgess or Mr. Welcher that put the lock event occurring before the trigger?
Objection.
Sustained.
May we approach, Your Honor?
Yes.
May I, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you. Back to my question. Was there any circumstance, based on your review, that if the TechStream event occurred at 12:31:38, that there was any circumstance that the lock event occurred before that trigger event?
There was not.
Did you create a PowerPoint for clarity's sake in March of 2025?
Yes.
Did you provide that to us?
I did.
What was the purpose of creating the PowerPoint?
The purpose of the PowerPoint was really to take a bunch of different data elements that were kind of placed throughout Mr. Burgess's report and Dr. Welcher's report and PowerPoint, and compile them into a single source, a single table, essentially, to show as clearly as possible what the conclusions would be if we look at the data as a whole.
When you created that PowerPoint presentation, did you create it with the intention of providing it to the defense, which would then be provided to the Commonwealth?
Yes.
Are you aware of whether or not that was disclosed to the Commonwealth as part of the normal discovery process?
No.
So the answer is no. The answer is no.
Following your presentation of the PowerPoint to us, at some point, did you receive from Mr. Burgess an amended report, an amended PowerPoint?
I received an amended PowerPoint by Mr. Burgess, not from him, though, from you.
Fair enough. Did that report, or did that PowerPoint, however you want to put it, markedly, was it any different than his January 2025 report?
Yes.
Did you note any conclusions? Did you note the conclusions that he came to in January 2025? Going back to the original report?
Yes.
Did you note conclusions and opinions that he came to in May of 2025?
Yes.
Were those two things different?
Sustained.
Were the conclusions, not his opinions, were his conclusions different?
Sustained.
Was there any difference in the two reports?
There was.
Tell me the differences.
In the first report, Mr. Burgess did some of the calculations that are necessary to correct or adjust the times based on certain approaches, but never went through the final step of applying those calculations to the times and coming up with a final time. In the supplemental report, he then essentially took that analysis to the end. He approached it in a new way, a different way than he had previously laid out in the first report, but then he also took it all the way to the end by applying those calculations to the times.
What were the main differences? Explain to the court and for the jurors, what were the main differences that he changed in the May 2025 report?
Contrasting it with the original
Correct.
Report, in
Right.
the original report, he laid out some methodologies for correcting the clock using phone calls that were shared between the vehicle and Mr. O'Keefe's phone. And in the supplemental report, he moved away from the phone call analysis and moved to attempting to align the clocks using a shared maneuver between the vehicle and the phone.
What was the shared maneuver?
It was a three-point turn.
Was that the same analysis that he had in January 2025?
He did not have that analysis in the 2025, January 2025 report.
Thank you. Based on the new information in the May 2025 report, what was the effect, as you see it, regarding the possible scenarios?
So I did the exact same process I did using the supplemental report as I did on the first report. And when I ran all those numbers and those calculations, it turned out there are now some scenarios in which the phone lock occurs after the end of the event. There's some scenarios where the phone lock occurs simultaneously, like literally at the same second. And there are some scenarios where it occurs before. So now there's a range.
So Mr. Burgess's report, his new report, his amended report, widened that gap to allow him to opine that there were scenarios that occurred after the phone lock event, correct?
Objection.
The objection sustained.
Did you prepare a PowerPoint presentation in furtherance of clarifying Mr. Burgess's analysis?
Objection.
Sustained.
Did you seek to clarify Mr. Burgess's analysis?
Objection.
Sustained.
Your Honor, may we approach?
Yes.
May I?
Yes.
Did you prepare a PowerPoint presentation in furtherance of your analysis?
Yes.
What was the reason and what was the purpose for your PowerPoint presentation?
I needed to include in my analysis the approach and the conclusions from the supplemental report by Mr. Burgess.
May I have a moment, Your Honor?
Yes.
May I approach?
Yes.
If you would mind taking a look at that document, it's a multi-page document I just handed you, and just flip through it and let me know once you've familiarized yourself with it. What is that document?
This is a printout of the PowerPoint presentation that I prepared.
Is it true and accurate?
Yes.
And it's complete?
It appears to be.
Your Honor, I would move for its admission, please.
I have no objection.
Okay.
May I have that back for you? Just a quick
second.
Okay. Your Honor, permission to display the PowerPoint presentation?
Okay.
Mr. DeSobra, can you still see with the lights off sufficient to see what's on the screen and what's in front of you?
Yes.
Okay. Do you recognize what's on the screen?
Yes.
What is that?
That is the title page of the PowerPoint that I prepared.
And what is how would you describe the PowerPoint?
So this PowerPoint is largely identical to the first PowerPoint I prepared in that it seeks to take all of the different approaches between the initial Burgess report, the supplemental Burgess report, and Dr. Welcher's report, lay out all of those approaches in one kind of coherent fashion so we can look at what conclusions we can draw from all of that data.
With court's permission, can we go to slide 2?
Yes. Mr. Jefferson, you can just use this PowerPoint. It's in evidence. You don't have to ask slide to slide.
Thank you, Your Honor. Taking a look at this next slide, what is this? What are we looking at?
This is a slide from Dr. Welcher's presentation that I was provided. Specifically, this is his slide number 33.
And what does it show?
This is where he introduces the first, acknowledgement that there's a difference between the time that Aperture calculated for the end of event 1162-2 and the lock event on Mr. O'Keefe's cell phone.
Is there anything in this slide that you disagree with, in Mr. Welcher's presentation that you disagree with? It's up on me.
I added the two green boxes and the text, the word after. That's not that's not Dr. Welcher's. And I added that because it's stated here that the event occurred within 26 seconds. But if we do the math, and he actually does the math, he really means after. It means the phone lock event occurred 26 seconds after the end of the vehicle event, as calculated.
No, I'm going to allow it.
The phone interaction happens how many seconds after the text stream event?
Based on this slide, 26 seconds.
Thank you. And the text stream event that we're talking about is what number?
1162-2.
And this slide, other than the green, is this slide or the portion of the slide that we're looking at, other than what you've described, is this directly from Mr. Welcher's own analysis or his PowerPoint?
Right. I added the green box around within, the dashed green box around the whole paragraph, the line, and the words after. Those are my additions.
Let's go to the next slide. Can you tell us what this is?
This is more or less a repeat of what's on the first slide, but just shown with a little more focus. The first slide is a little busy. So what
did you create this, or is this from Dr. Welcher's report?
I created everything on this slide apart from in the top right. That came from Dr. Welcher's slide 33.
Although you created the slide, where's the data coming from for this slide?
All of the data on this slide and all of my subsequent slides comes from the Aperture reports collectively, either Dr. Welcher's report or slides, or Mr. Burgess's first and second reports.
What did their analysis reveal in terms of the exact time of the lock event for Mr. O'Keefe's phone?
So in their analysis, in Aperture's analysis, they report the Lexus event 1162-2 ends at 12:31:43, and they also report there's a phone lock at 12:32:09. So if we just simply take the difference in those two times, we get 26 seconds.
If you were to add the 5 seconds back to 12:31:38, which is the actual trigger event, what would you come up with?
31 seconds.
Which of the two, in your expert opinion, which of those two numbers is more accurate as it relates to the trigger event?
If we wanted to conduct the analysis relative to the trigger, it would be better to use the actual trigger time. However, as long as we're consistent through the analysis, it's not entirely wrong to use the end. It would be wrong if I suddenly switched up and started talking about this relative to the trigger event, but they present it as the end of the event, so I conduct the rest of my analysis using that convention.
Is another word for the end of the event the end of the recording?
End of the recording, yeah. When I say event, what I mean by that is the data event, the data recording event.
But the trigger event itself, 12:31:38.
Correct.
Did you put a name on this gap, if you will, this time frame?
Yes, I did. For the sake of the rest of the analysis that I'm going to do, I thought it would be helpful to just refer to this difference in time as John's interaction window.
And that refers directly to the interaction with the phone, the human interaction of locking the phone.
The 12:32:09 lock.
Okay, let's go to the next slide, please. What does this slide show us?
So this here, what I'm doing is I'm kind of laying out the bounds of what I mean in John's interaction window, which should make, we have a lot of numbers to go through here, and so this should give us a very easy metric for kind of determining whether we have an event before or after. So what I mean by that is, when we calculate John's interaction window, if that number comes out and is positive, that means the phone interaction occurs after the end of the vehicle event. And if we calculate John's interaction window and that number becomes a negative value, then that means the phone interaction occurs before. So now we have just a convention we can use really quickly to say, is it positive or is it negative? And we can maybe spare ourselves some of the math with 1,000 numbers.
So positive means what? One more time.
Positive, John's interaction window positive, means the phone lock occurs after the end of vehicle event 1162-2.
Got it. Let's go to the next slide, please. What does this slide show us?
So what I'm saying here, I'm kind of laying the foundation for why we're going to even do this. Why do we need to start doing math on these clocks? So fundamentally, the phone, Mr. O'Keefe's phone, and the vehicle, Ms. Reed's vehicle, they're separate clocks. And it's very unlikely that they're going to be aligned perfectly in time. Right? If I compared my watch to your watch, it would probably be off. And that's the same case for any two independent clock sources. So Aperture, in their collective reports, propose a number of different ways in which that can be corrected. So I'm going to go through all of those ways that Aperture has proposed and show if we align the clocks based on how they laid out, does John's interaction window stay positive or does it ever become negative? Where does it end up when we run all those analyses? Or another way to put it is, does the phone interaction always occur after the end of the vehicle event?
And what did you determine?
Based on the initial reports,
yes,
the phone interaction always occurs after the end of the vehicle event.
Did all of the information that's on this slide come from the same source or multiple sources, meaning Mr. Burgess and Dr. Welcher?
In the PowerPoint as a whole, all the information comes from the Aperture reports collectively.
Okay.
From Dr. Welcher and Mr. Burgess.
Did Mr. Burgess make any adjustments from his original report to his subsequent report in May of 2025?
Yes.
Let's go to slide 6, please. Tell me about this slide.
Yeah, so this is the first adjustment we're going to talk about. That was, and this one comes from Mr. Burgess's original report. And to summarize this adjustment, this is a key on timing adjustment, and we're going to show that the key on, the actual turning of the vehicle on, occurs about 3 seconds before that time gets registered in the infotainment. So the time we see is basically stale by 3 seconds.
We're all familiar with how computers turn on. When you say key on, do you mean a physical key, or could it be a push button to turn the car on?
In this case, it's a button. I refer to key on because generally that event is considered the key on in vehicle parlance, regardless of whether there's a physical key or it's a push button.
So those 3 seconds mean what? What's the difference between pushing that button and 3 seconds later that you just described?
It means that when we're trying to use the timestamps that were recovered from the infotainment system that show when the vehicle was keyed on or turned on, that the vehicle was actually or likely turned on 3 seconds before that.
Do you know where the 3 second conclusion came from in Mr. Burgess's report?
That came from the testing that Aperture conducted with the Exemplar Lexus that they purchased.
Was there anything in the report that indicated testing, this type of exact testing on Ms. Reed's actual Lexus?
No.
Do you have an opinion as to whether or not all Lexuses, at least of this make and model and year, would have the exact same 3 second delay, or could that be different?
It could be different. In their testing, they only tested one exemplar vehicle. So I think there was a solid foundation that the exemplar that was used exhibited this 3 second delay. It was a very close match in terms of part numbers and software versions to Ms. Reed's Lexus. But without any kind of testing of, let's say, a second vehicle, a second exemplar, we wouldn't know. We wouldn't have any basis to say it must be three. We could test a second vehicle and it could be five. So we say, well, there's a delay, but it varies vehicle to vehicle. They could have tested a second vehicle and found it's also three. And then you start to build some confidence that maybe it is three across every vehicle. But with only testing one and not testing the subject vehicle, it is difficult to say with absolute certainty it would be 3 seconds.
What is your opinion about best practices with regard to trying to create this gap for purposes of coming to an opinion or an analysis?
So because we don't know whether or not this specifically would apply to Ms. Reed's vehicle. The best way to conduct that analysis would be to do the entire thing with the key switch adjustment at 3 seconds. Because if we're going to use a value, 3 is the most reasonable one because that's the one shown in testing. But we should also do the entire analysis without it in case we feel that that's the most appropriate. So, in fact, that's what I do and will show is I ran the analysis both ways, with and without, to be as conservative as possible.
Did your review of Mr. Burgess's report indicate that he ran the analysis both ways?
He did not.
Let's go to slide 7. What are we looking at here?
This is an excerpt from Mr. Burgess's original report. His page 28 and his page, there's a screenshot also from his page 30 at the bottom. And this is where he states in that report that when they were doing the testing with the exemplar, they observed across 4 different key-on cycles this 3-second difference. So what I mean by that is they had a video camera in the car that had a timer on it. And so in the video, you can see the button pressed. So in their testing, for example, they pressed the button at 21:48:05, and that's sort of nailed down. When they went back and downloaded the data from the infotainment, the key-on was logged in the infotainment as 21:48:08. So there's the 3 seconds. That's where they're getting that from, and that's what he states highlighted in red there. It's a little hard to read, but it basically says the average across 4 runs was 3 seconds.
The 3-second delay, was that actually in his report?
This is the only point in the report it's mentioned.
I guess what I'm asking, it was an artful question. The portion to the left, is that his report or your report?
That is his report. Everything on the left-hand side of the slide comes from Mr. Burgess's report.
So the 3-second delay was noted in his report?
It was noted.
Did he apply the 3 seconds in his analysis?
He did not.
Did he indicate in his report why he ignored that 3-second delay?
He did not.
So stand as to that question.
I'll rephrase it.
Strike the answer.
Did he indicate in his report the reason that he did not apply the 3-second correction?
He did not.
When you do apply the 3-second correction, what do you come up with as it relates to the 26 seconds from the end of the recording?
So the positive 26 second window, if we only apply the 3-second key on, grows to positive 29 seconds.
If you applied the same 3 seconds to the trigger event time, now what does the gap?
That gap would grow to a positive 34 seconds.
Between the trigger event and what?
The phone lock.
In your opinion, was it best practice to not account for that 3-second delay between the on switch and the data coming on?
Sustained, ask it differently.
What, in your opinion, would be the best practice in terms of this 3 seconds that was noted in the exemplar vehicle?
The best practice would be to run the analysis with that adjustment included and without that adjustment included. Because like I stated, without testing of an additional vehicle, we really don't know if the 3 seconds is just a specific behavior of that exemplar or if it's representative of all Lexuses of this type.
Let's go to slide 8, please. Tell us what we're looking at in this slide.
So now we're going to get into the next adjustments. That first adjustment we just talked about was really a vehicle-to-vehicle adjustment. We haven't talked about the phone yet. We're going to get into the phone now and talk about aligning that. But we had to get through the internal adjustment that has to get done first. Now we're going to look on the subsequent slides here at all of the different ways the Aperture reports compared the vehicle to Mr. Apeep's phone.
Is there any additional adjustment that you believe should be made?
The APTA reports lay out two methodologies for adjusting. There is a methodology based on phone calls, and there's a methodology based on the three-point term.
And where did you get that information from?
From the APTA reports.
In Mr. Burgess's original report, I'm differentiating, the January report, which did he use to determine his determination of the clock skew?
In his initial January report, he never actually takes the calculation to the end by applying the differences in times to the calculated time for 1162-2, but he does do the math, which I'll show, for the differences on these phone calls.
In terms of Dr. Welcher's report, did he identify a GPS point of 154 at all?
Yes.
How did he describe that GPS data point?
He describes in his initial PowerPoint slides as 0.154 aligning with the end of vehicle event 1162-1, talking about a different event now. This is the three-point turn event. So he uses that as an anchor point.
And that anchor point, you said, was the end of the text stream event, or the end of the recording of that text stream event.
Correct. The APTA reports consistently reference everything from the end of the events.
Let's go to slide 9, please. What are we looking at here?
On the left is an excerpt of page 33 from Mr. Burgess's initial report. And what he shows here is he has identified 7 call logs that exist both in the infotainment from Ms. Reed's Lexus and in Mr. O'Keefe's phone. He puts them in a table form. Then he actually goes on and calculates the difference between those two times. So that's what I meant by he sort of does the math. He makes my job a little easier, and the numbers are already there. He just never applies these to any of the times. So that's where I step in and say, if I take that third column that he lays out, those are in seconds. If I apply those seconds, that adjustment to 12:31:43, where do we end up with John's interaction window in those times?
What did you conclude in terms of finishing the work?
Sure. I did all of them. And so I highlight on this particular slide, I just highlighted the very first one he has in here. In that case, he identified that Mr. O'Keefe's phone was 2 seconds slow relative to the infotainment system. So if we apply only that adjustment, then John's interaction window becomes positive 28 seconds.
Did Mr. Burgess apply all of the potential offsets?
He didn't apply any of the offsets. He calculated all of them, but he didn't apply any of them.
Did you ultimately apply all of the offsets?
Yes, I did.
And what did you determine?
Regardless of which offset you apply, John's interaction window remains positive. The number changes, but it remains positive.
Let's take a look at those one at a time if we can. Let's have the next slide.
So on this slide, I just took the other end of the spectrum. There's a large range in values in this table. Mr. Burgess doesn't show the sign conventions on here, but actually...
What do you mean sign conventions?
Sign conventions. He doesn't show, when he calculates the difference, whether it's positive or negative. All the numbers in the table don't have a sign, don't have a plus or minus in front of them, but there's an implication. Some of them are plus, some of them are minus. So the first one that we just looked at showed we had 2 seconds slow. There's another value in here that's on the other end of that. It shows that Mr. O'Keefe's phone is 21 seconds fast now relative to the infotainment. So that's the largest value in the table we could take that would bring John's interaction window down now. And so if we apply just that adjustment, John's interaction window becomes a positive 5.
Take a look at slide 11, if we could, please. What are we looking at here?
So I've shifted now from the phone calls, and now we're going to talk about the three-point turn alignment. And the three-point turn alignment is first presented in Dr. Welcher's slide from his presentation here. And in this, he doesn't say it explicitly, but he provides some math on the screen, which is a little hard to read. But he puts some math on the screen that shows he's aligning this 0.154 from Mr. O'Keefe's phone to the end of event 1162-1. This is the prior event. This is a three-point turn. And so he aligns, he says this is basically how you align it, and he doesn't do the math. Again, he lays out that there's, he says, a 19.2 second difference. I actually just adjusted that to 20, which is the most conservative way to interpret that. I don't think we have the accuracy here to talk about tenths of a second. Nevertheless, I just rounded that up to 20, and when we apply that 20 seconds to our event 1162-2, then John's interaction window becomes positive 6. That's just applying this. We're not combining anything. We're just applying the difference shown in the slide.
And that positive interaction window, is that calculated based on information directly from Dr. Welcher's report?
Yes.
Let's go to slide 12. What are we looking at here? What is this table?
This is a table I made. We've talked about a lot of different approaches to how these clocks can be aligned and a lot of different variables. So I tried to summarize them in one table, put them all together, because some of them we can combine. We can combine the key on with either a phone call or a three-point turn, but we can't combine, for example, a three-point turn and a phone call. That's not valid. So I put all the possible combinations, all of them, with, without key switch, phone calls, and 0.154 on one table, and I calculated John's interaction window for all valid combinations from the aperture reports. And when we do that, the result is that regardless of what adjustment we make, all of the numbers are positive, meaning regardless of what adjustment we make, the phone lock event always occurs after the end of event 1162-2.
Did Mr. Burgess, in your review of his report in January 2025, did he ever undertake all possible offset calculations?
No.
In his May 2025 report, did he undertake all possible offset calculations?
No.
What is your opinion in terms of best practices regarding calculations of this sort?
I think if there's sufficient data, there's testing or research or literature that in a specific case supports there is a best path or a best method, then we should use that. In this case, I don't think there is a best practice. There isn't any literature I'm aware of that would specify exactly the best path to align all of these. So in the absence of any external data to support one path, the most valid approach is look at all of them as a whole and then draw the conclusion from the totality of that data rather than cherry picking a single point.
Can you testify to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty whether all potential offsets that were described in Aperture's original report, January of 2025, result in a positive interaction window?
Yes.
And what is that opinion?
Regardless of what adjustment or combination of adjustments we make from the original reports, John's interaction window remains positive.
Does the positive interaction window mean the lock event occurred after or before the text stream event?
It means the lock event occurs after the end of the text stream event, 1162-2.
You've already indicated that you received a second report, May of 2025. Correct?
That's correct.
In that report, is there the same aligned clock skew alignment or a different clock skew alignment that Mr. Burgess now undertakes?
Mr. Burgess undertakes a different alignment in that report.
Let's go to slide 13. Describe what we're looking at in this slide.
So what I have here on the left is a screenshot of page 42 from Mr. Burgess's supplemental report. And so now he's done two things new here. He's identified a new method for aligning the data based on the three-point turn. So now he's kind of following where Dr. Welcher started, but he's approaching it a little differently. And secondly, he is now calculating the actual time. He's doing the difference calculation, and he's applying that to the time. So now he's taking the calculation all the way through, which is a little different from the prior reports. And so when he does that, he makes my job really easy because I didn't have to do really any math now. He comes up that there is a range now. So prior to this point, the original report by Mr. Burgess and Dr. Welcher reports all used discrete points in time, right? They sought to find an event that occurs at a singular second and another event at a singular second and align based on that. This is a little bit of a departure from that approach. Mr. Burgess is now using a range of times, a range of uncertainty. He basically assesses that the three-point turn data from the phone and the three-point turn data in 1162-1 cannot be precisely aligned down to a single point. Rather, they overlap in this range of seconds. And so he then says that that range must be applied. So now we have to apply a range. And what we end up with is 9 possible values. So it kind of looks like one conclusion, but really there's 9 conclusions on this slide. And so if we just applying the math he has in the supplemental report, John's interaction window now has a range of 9 possible values, and that range spans from +5 now to -3. So we have 5 positive values, we have 1 value that's 0, and the 0 would mean it's simultaneous, and then we have 3 negative values.
Does Mr. Burgess indicate in his report that any one of those values is more likely than any of the other values?
He does not provide any data or analysis to support one point being preferential over the other 8.
And are there more or fewer positive results in his analysis than negative?
There are more positive numbers in that range of 9 than there are negative numbers.
Does Mr. Burgess's new data indicate anything about Dr. Welcher's analysis about the GPS data point 154 being at the end of the three-point turn?
He opines in that aligning the three-point turn on a singular point is not, and I'm paraphrasing because I don't know the exact way he states it, but not the preferred method.
Is Mr. Burgess's analysis consistent or inconsistent with Mr. Welcher's determination that GPS point 154 was at the end of the text stream event?
Objection.
System.
Does Mr. Burgess in his report indicate whether he agrees or disagrees with Dr. Welcher's analysis?
I don't remember specifically.
In your opinion, I asked you about Mr. Burgess's report. Now I'm going to ask you about your opinion. In your opinion, is this new offset any more likely or reasonable than any other offsets previously proposed by Mr. Burgess?
I don't think it is more or less likely. I think it is a valid approach, certainly. And so I think the results from the additional analysis should be included with the analysis of all of the results so far.
And none of those results are more or less likely than any of the others, correct?
Sustained.
Are any of the results, in your opinion, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, are any of the results any more or less likely than any of the others?
It's my opinion they're all equally weighted.
Did Mr. Burgess account for the 3-second offset that we talked about earlier in his May 2025 report, his new report?
I did not see any mention of that in his supplemental report, and certainly it's the 3 seconds isn't present in his math. I don't see it there.
Let's go on to slide 14, please. Describe what we're looking at here in this table.
This is very similar to the table we looked at previously, where I look at all possible combinations. Now, however, I just have a lot more data points to show, so I've had to break the table into two tables. So we're going to look at this, and then we'll look at slide 15 next, which is the second table. I just couldn't cram 30 lines under one slide.
Let's move to the next slide, then. Is this a continuation of the
second half? So think of these as a singular table. I just had to split them up. If we head back to slide 14, we'll start there. So this slide, I'm not accounting for the key on, and that's the main difference between my two tables. Table one, I'm not accounting for the 3-second key on. And table two, I am.
When you say key on, you're talking about that 3-second delay.
Correct.
Okay, go ahead.
But again, I want to make sure we're thinking about this as a singular table, because that's where we'll draw our conclusions from. So the first lines of the table, we've already seen those. Those were in my original table. I haven't changed those. That's the same math that's been there. All I did was I added the 9 points now from Mr. Burgess's supplemental report using the range he shows. And so now we can see if we include that, now we get some positive numbers for John's interaction window. We get that zero. And again, the zero would imply that the end of event 1162-2 is happening exactly at the same second as the phone lock. So it's kind of not on one side or the other. So I think it should be thought of as separate. And then we have 3 negative values, which would imply that phone lock occurs before the end of 1162-2.
And did you already mention the simultaneous, the one that was simultaneous?
When John's interaction window is zero, correct?
Zero.
That would imply simultaneity.
All right, is this 14 or 15? It's 14, let's move to 15. Now, this is the continuation of that. Mentally, we'll just continue that same table?
Correct.
Okay.
Just a continuation. Imagine your mind is just row 16 to 30.
Okay.
And it's the same thing, same format, except for now we're just adding in that key on adjustment, because again, I think the analysis should be run with and without it. And so now when we run this with the key on adjustment, we get 14 of these 15. John's interaction window is positive to various degrees. And one of them, it's zero, again, simultaneous. And there are no negative values with this adjustment.
Can we go to the next slide, 16, please? What are we looking at here?
This is the summary then of that table, kind of a verbal summary of the giant 30-line table now. And if we look at all of the possibilities from all of the aperture reports collectively, then we can draw some pretty straightforward conclusions. 25 of those 30 possibilities result in interaction with the O'Keefe phone after the end of event 1162-2. Looking at all the possibilities, 2 of the 30 result in interaction where it's simultaneous. That's the zeros, the present in both tables. And then looking at all 30, 3 of the 30 result in interaction with the phone before the end of event 1162-2.
Do you have an opinion as to which of these particular offsets that you've described, these 30 possibilities, should be applied in this case?
No.
Why is that?
Each of the approaches have their own individual strengths, and each of them have their own individual weaknesses, and there is not really any published literature, any research, or any testing done that I'm aware of that would suggest one really stands head and shoulders above another one of the methods. So I think the most fair way to present it is to look at, again, if we combine everything together, then we can draw some conclusions like this in terms of how many of the total result in one outcome or another.
Is every data point that we're looking at and that you've been talking about, are these all drawn directly from Aperture's reports?
That's correct. I have not proposed any methods for aligning the clocks myself. All of the methods that comprise these 30 are from the Aperture reports themselves.
Based on your analysis of the Aperture, or your review of the Aperture analysis, is there any ability to say to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that the TechStream event occurred after the last physical interaction with John O'Keefe's phone?
Yes, there would be three out of the 30 possibilities would result in that.
Do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty that it did happen after the TechStream event?
Okay. Sustain.
Of the 30, what's the percentage of possible events that occurred, possible scenarios, I should say, wherein the TechStream event occurred after the last interaction with John's phone? What's the percentage of it?
That's sustained.
You said it's 3 out of 30, correct?
Yes.
Is that 10%?
That is 10%.
No, it's sustained and it's stricken.
What percentage is 3? Just do basic math for me. What is the percentage between 3 and 30?
Sustained.
If I told you hypothetically.
I'm going to see you tie back for a second.
Following your analysis of the totality of the possible scenarios, did you come to a conclusion that the vast majority, let me rephrase that, did you come to any conclusion about the numbers as they relate to the positive interactions versus the negative? And when I say positive versus negative, I'm talking about the phraseology that you used. John's phone interaction being in the positive side versus John's phone interaction being in the negative side.
Yes.
And what were those?
Of the 30 possibilities, 25 of them, it's a positive. John's interaction window is positive for 25 of them.
And only 3 were negative?
Correct. Only 3 were of the 30 were negative.
Okay. Okay, we can take that slide down. Is there a data recorder on the Toyota SUV that we've been talking about, that 2021 Toyota SUV 570, that's designed to record impact?
Yes.
What is that? What is that mechanism?
That would be the airbag control module.
The ACM?
ACM.
Did Correct. You look at that?
I was provided a copy of the download from the ACM.
What did the data recorder indicate, if anything, related to any impact on January 29th, 2022?
There were no recorded events whatsoever on the ACM.
Did the vehicle control history record whether there was any history of a collision on that car, ever?
No.
What does the vehicle control history record specifically?
It records a lot of operational parameters about the vehicle. What I mean by that is it records things like what the driver is doing, for example, steering wheel angle, accelerator pedal position, whether the brake is being pressed. It also records what the vehicle is doing, for example, speed or the engine RPM or the accelerations of it.
Does the TechStream data event indicate that there's a, and I'm talking about very specifically, the TechStream data, does that indicate whether or not there's a collision in the car?
No.
Does the TechStream data event mean that if you find a TechStream data event or a trigger event, does that mean that the airbags are deployed?
No.
Does it mean that the vehicle impacted with something solid?
No.
Does it mean that the vehicle impacted with a pedestrian?
No.
You reviewed the raw TechStream data associated with the entirety of Ms. Swede's vehicle, did you not?
Yes.
How many TechStream events or triggers were found on Ms. Reed's vehicle during the course of the 8-month period prior to January 29th?
So can you narrow that, Mr. Jackson?
Sure.
I've objected the whole line of it.
And I need to see what's up there. Mr. Jackson, how much longer? I'm just trying to figure out.
I'm wrapping it up, Judge.
Okay.
It's not going to be long. A few more questions.
I'm not curbing you in any way. We just...
No, understand. Respectfully, it won't be very much longer. You reviewed the TechStream data, otherwise known as the triggers, for the entirety of Ms. Reed's vehicle, correct?
Yes.
How many trigger events did you find in the life of the car?
Not counting 1162-2.
Let's stop there.
Right. Prior to 1162-2, there were 19 prior events.
And 19 total events, correct?
Correct.
And how many collisions were clocked by any recorder on that car?
None of the events were triggered by a collision.
And last question, do any of the TechStream events or do any of the data that you've reviewed either yourself through Mr. Burgess's report, through Dr. Welch's report, do any of the data indicate that there was a collision on January 29th, 2022 at any time?
Objection.
Ask it differently.
What did you find in terms of, I want to narrow this question to January 29th, 2022. What did you find in terms of any data regarding a collision?
Neither of the events that occurred on that date were triggered by a collision.
Thank you. May I have just a moment, Your Honor?
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.